The next speaker is Bill Stark, who hardly requires any introduction to most of you. Bill's a property and commercial member of council of many years' experience. In fact, came to the borough in 1998 after having been admitted in 1988 and practiced as a solicitor for almost 10 years at a leading city commercial firm. Bill now practices and has practiced for a number of years in commercial and property disputes of all description. In particular, he has a large practice in mortgages and disputes relating to mortgages, in particular in the Supreme Court. His paper today concerns that aspect of property interest concerning joint tenancies, which is of direct relevance to all of us, and in particular issues relating to the severance of joint tenancies in the light of the recent significant decision of His Honour Justice Hargrave in Sachs against Klein. I'll hand you over to Bill Stark to elucidate further on his paper. Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. Good morning, everybody. As Tony outlined, the main focus of today's discussion will be Justice Hargrave's decision in Sachs and Klein. In the paper, I've given a bit of an introduction, pointing out that Part 4 of the Property Law Act is the relevant legislative regime. John's already given you a quick overview of that as well. And the fact that VCAT has almost exclusive jurisdiction over applications to divide co-owned land. The exceptions to VCAT's exclusive jurisdiction are set out in subsection 2 of section 234C of the Property Law Act. That subsection says the Supreme and the County Court have jurisdiction to hear an application under this part if the matter, which is the subject of the application, relates to a proceeding under first part 9 of the Property Law Act, that's the de facto property law, the de facto property disputes, or part 4 of the Administration and Probate Act, or the Partnership Act. Now, that's how that case that John talked about ended up in the court. And Sachs and Klein ended up in the court because of the Part 4 of the Administration and Probate Act jurisdiction. In the paper today, apart from Hargrave's decision, I also, if we have enough time, I'll have a quick glance at making an application to VCAT to sever a joint tenancy. But before we go there, I just wanted to give a quick refresher course. The difference between joint tenancy and tenancy in common. I know it's Property Law 101, but I just want to just refresh your memory about it. Basically, the essential difference for today's purposes of those two types of co-ownership is what happens on the death of one of the co-owners. As you know, in a joint tenancy, the deceased's interest in the property vests in the remaining owners through the right of survivorship. On the other hand, in a tenancy in common, the deceased's interest in the property falls into their estate, and it's dealt with then in accordance with succession law. How do you create a joint tenancy? Basically, there have to be four unities: the unity of title, unity of interest, unity of possession, and unity of time. So how do you terminate a joint tenancy? Well, firstly, and most obviously, on the death of the second last of the joint owners by operation of the right of survivorship, when the land vests entirely in the one remaining joint owner. Then there's partition or sale, or as it's now called, I can't even remember the wording, by sale or partition under the Property Law Act provisions, and I've set those out in Schedule B to the paper. And thirdly, for today's purposes, by severance. So, during his or her lifetime, a joint tenant can defeat the right of survivorship by converting the interest held as a joint tenant into one held as a tenant in common, severing the joint tenancy. Once you've severed the joint tenancy, it can't be reinstated. You're probably aware that a joint tenancy can be severed by agreement between the co-owners. Obviously, there'd be no litigation if that was the way it happened most common. You can sever the joint tenancy by alienation of the whole of a joint tenant's interest in the land during their lifetime. That alienation isn't necessarily voluntary. What I've put in there as an example is the operation of the Bankruptcy Act. Upon bankruptcy, a joint owner's interest in the joint tenancy vests in a trustee in bankruptcy, and that severs the joint tenancy. In the book Land Law, which is on the desk over there, a sixth edition by Peter Butt, he lists the following as further methods of severing the joint tenancies. First, severance by course of conduct, where the parties act as though they are tenants in common, not joint tenants, and that's quite relevant to today's case. Severance by court order, for example, as a result of family court proceedings, where the family court orders the joint interest be severed and the parties hold their interest as tenants in common thereafter. Severance by merger, if one of the joint tenants acquires a further interest in the land that's different from that already held as joint tenant. And interestingly, severance following homicide. You know that public policy prevents a person from benefiting from their own crime. When I read this, I immediately thought of the Wales King case, which you probably all remember, the highly publicised society murders, where Matthew Wales murdered his mother and stepfather. The follow-up to that, of course, was that he was disinherited from his entitlements under his parents' estate, and there was ongoing litigation between his wife and the other siblings in the family. In the end, I think it was resolved by his son taking his interest, his infant son taking his interest in the estate. So timing of severance, when is it too late? Is it too late, for example, once the right of survivorship has actually taken effect? As is inevitably the case in litigation, Saxon Klein arose at the edge of where the law is clear. Justice Hargrave was called upon to determine an acrimonious dispute between the widow of a property owner and the deceased's brother, who was his business partner in respect of the property. It's not clear from the judgment, but I'm assuming that the widow claimed under Part 4 of the Administration and Probate Act. Now, I've given an outline of the factual background in the paper. Justice Hargrave begins the judgment with six paragraphs about the facts, and I just wanted to read those to you. One, Michael and David Klein were brothers, born in Melbourne. In December 1994, when Michael was aged 29 years and David 30 years, they purchased a residential flat in East St Kilda as an investment. They were registered as joint proprietors of the flat. Two, at the time of purchase, Michael and his newlywed wife were living in Tel Aviv, Israel. David, who was recently separated from his first wife and in the process of divorce proceedings, lived in Melbourne. Three, on 26 December 2005, following a short illness, Michael died in Jerusalem, Israel. He left a widow, Daniel Klein, and four young sons. In these circumstances, as the surviving joint tenant, David claims that he became entitled to be registered as the sole proprietor of the flat. He lodged a survivorship application and was duly registered as sole proprietor. Further, at that time, the mortgage over the flat was repaid in full with monies advanced by the brother's father, Tom Klein. It is not clear if that advance was by way of gift or loan. Tom Klein has reserved his position on that issue, I infer, until the result of this proceeding is known. Four, the plaintiff, Wayne Sachs, is a solicitor. He is the administrator of Michael's estate. As Michael left no will, his sole heir is his wife, Danielle. Five, in this proceeding, the plaintiff seeks a declaration that David holds the flat on trust for himself and the plaintiff as tenants in common in equal shares. Six, the trial was bitterly fought with allegations that family members have concocted evidence to suit their respective cases. From the evidence as a whole, it was obvious that David's harsh attitude to his sister-in-law was driven by his father, Tom, who did not give evidence. It is regrettable that a family dispute of this kind could not be resolved by sensible and compassionate agreement, thus avoiding the expenditure, etc., etc. You may be able to guess where his honour's going by the use of language. I've highlighted in bold the bits that really stand out. Newlywed wife, four young sons, harsh attitude, could not be resolved by sensible and compassionate agreement, all of which point to the result. To avoid further suspense, I'll let you know the widow succeeded. So some more facts. The purchase of the flat in St Kilda came about after the brothers each inherited $50,000 from their paternal grandfather. David decided originally to use his inheritance to purchase an investment property on a negatively geared basis. He initially intended to purchase the flat in his own name. In fact, he signed a contract in his own name and with a nominee clause. But his brother Michael was not working when he was living in Israel at the time, and he had no investments other than the inheritance. That was placed in a term deposit in Australia, and Michael was managing it for him. So Michael telephoned his brother and invited him to participate equally in the investment in the flat. Michael readily agreed. They thought the purchase would cost about $90,000 all up, and they intended to raise $60,000 of that by way of mortgage and use $15,000 of their investment from the inheritance each to make up the money. David approached, this is all taken from the judgment, David approached a family friend, Dassey Herzberg, who conducted cheapest conveyancing company. Now, you're all solicitors in the room, I assume, so you can see already this is fraught with disaster, but in fact, Ms. Herzberg did exactly the right thing. There's even written evidence in the written correspondence in the evidence in the trial, which shows that she explained to the brothers as co-owners, they could purchase it either as joint tenants or tenants in common, and she actually explained to them the difference. David gave evidence that his consideration of the issue led him to prefer a joint tenancy for the reason that if one were to die, there wouldn't be any third parties involved and that the property would simply go to the other. Now, immediately, obviously, David's in the process of divorce. You can understand his thinking on the issue. Michael's newly wed. Why would he agree to that? David swears that Michael said that'll be fine. David's evidence as to his reasons to preferring a joint tenancy were considering his own personal situation, waiting for a divorce, and appreciating the fact that a third party could potentially cause problems. He didn't want this situation to arise. As far as he was concerned, this was a family venture. Now, why that doesn't include the widow, I don't know. He was doing it as a long-term investment for both himself and Michael, and he didn't want anybody else involved. He went about raising the funds to settle the purchase. In summary, each brother contributed $14,000, Tom, the father, contributed $6,000, and the balance for the purchase price, stamp duty, costs, etc., were funded by a $60,000 mortgage. That loan, if you ever have a contract subject to finance, you'll be aware that sometimes finance is delayed, and inevitably, in this case, finance was delayed. So the brothers used their investment in the short term to fund the purchase until the finance came through. After the purchase was settled, David did everything. Michael basically was still living in Israel, and David arranged for the leasing, David arranged for the maintenance, David arranged for some renovations to be undertaken. He did all the tasks usually performed by a landlord or an agent, and Michael had no involvement in it whatsoever. Unfortunately for David, he kept meticulous accounts and records of the investments, and he ensured equality of everything between he and Michael at all times. Michael never asked about the flat in their regular brotherly telephone conversations, and he never provided Michael with an accounting for the investment. The flat was negatively geared after the finance came through. To the extent that the rental was insufficient to cover the mortgage repayments and other outgoings, the difference came from their term deposit investment. David paid all of Michael's contributions because he held a power of attorney anyway, so basically he did everything. So there's the facts, the factual background that gets us to this point. Justice Hargrave begins his analysis of the law at paragraph 25 of his judgment. He says the relevant legal principles to be applied may be summarised as follows. One, where property is conveyed to two or more persons who are named as transferees without further specification as to whether they hold the title as joint tenants or tenants in common, they are deemed by operation of subsection 4 of section 33 of the TLA to hold the legal interest as joint tenants. However, that section does not preclude the operation of equity. Two, unless there is evidence to indicate the transferees held a different intention, equity will follow the law. In the High Court decision of Della Hunt against Carmody, Chief Justice Gibbs spells that out. However, and this is a curious comment, equity favours tenants in common as a form of concurrent ownership, probably to give effect to the maxim, equity is equality. In equity, even slight circumstances are enough to indicate the parties did not intend to hold the property as joint tenants. Now, just stopping there, all the evidence was that they did intend to hold it as joint tenants. They, in fact, were registered as joint tenants, and they gave written instructions to the conveyancer to register them as joint tenants. But moving on, as stated by Chief Justice Gibbs, slight circumstances would have been enough to indicate that it was intended that there should not be a joint tenancy. Equity had a dislike for joint tenancies because their effect was to make the ultimate ownership of the property depend on the chance of survivorship. And in the words of Snell's principle of equity, there is here no equality except perhaps in equality of chance. Obviously, in commercial arrangements, a joint tenancy isn't going to work because two commercial ventures aren't willing to take the chance on which of them is going to survive. Therefore, irrespective of the position on the certificate of title, equity may intervene to impose a tenancy in common. Prima facie, the provision of purchase money in equal shares is consistent with an intention to hold property as joint tenants. However, even if the parties provide purchase money in equal shares, equity will presume the parties intended to hold the beneficial interests as tenants in common in circumstances where a mortgage is made to them jointly, or where the persons to whom the property is conveyed acquire it as partners or as participants in a joint undertaking. Now, they're the relevant words for the purpose of the current case. These are not rigid categories. The application of the equitable presumption is not confined to formal business structures. As stated by Justice Mandy in Zenu and Katsaris, the right of survivorship has no place among merchants. A joint business venture or undertaking of a more informal kind, lacking the system and continuity or pursuit of profit of a business, would still give rise to equities leaning towards a tenancy in common of the beneficial interest. The equitable presumption may be rebutted by evidence of a common intention by the co-owners to acquire the property as joint tenants. Common intention must be actual, not presumed. If there is ambiguity as to the existence of a common intention, the court very properly leans to the construction which creates a tenancy in common in preference to a joint tenancy. Further, a proved common intention to acquire a property as joint tenants is not conclusive. The distinguishing characteristic of a tenancy in common is the holding of distinct yet undivided shares in land. In contrast, joint tenants have a full unity of interest. If parties describe their interest in words which suggest distinct shares are to be held, their words prevent the creation of joint tenancy. As has been pointed out in numerous cases, the evidentiary threshold to establish a division is easily met. Anything which in the slightest degree indicates an intention to divide the property must be held to abrogate the idea of a joint tenancy and create a tenancy in common. The judgment given by Chief Justice Gibbs in Della Hunt and Carmody was the only written judgment delivered in the case. The other four judges hearing it, Wilson, Brennan, Dean and Dawson, all simply said, "I agree." There was a combination of factors that His Honour Justice Hargrave relied on to find that, in fact, there was a joint undertaking here. I've outlined some of those already, that they paid for everything equally. There was a joint mortgage. David was meticulous in the keeping of his records to ensure that all the expenses, and including the cost of the renovation, were shared equally between them. Okay, so I'm running out of time here. I'll just have to quickly skip through a little bit. Having found a joint undertaking, His Honour noted at paragraph 30 that the equitable presumption of tenancy in common is applicable, and that required David to rebut that presumption. He was required to rebut it by clear and cogent evidence, and there are three reasons for that. First, because of equity's dislike of joint tenancies, especially in a commercial setting. Secondly, because the requisite intention is to be found in conversations between two proprietors, one of whom has since died and is unable to give evidence. Therefore, there is a special need for convincing proof. And thirdly, because there's been a significant lapse of time since the conversations occurred, which raises concerns about the potential effect of the passage of time on memory. His Honour concluded that although they had agreed to be registered as joint tenants of the flat, the brothers nevertheless intended to divide their interests in the flat equally. His Honour's reasons were at paragraph 64 and following. First, the flat was purchased as an investment for the benefit of each brother equally. Second, consistent with the brother's intention at the time of the purchase, David meticulously ensured the income and expenses were shared equally. And third, David had said, and there was evidence about it, that he always thought that he had a moral obligation to share the income from the flat with Michael's family. And after Michael's death, he said he would do so on a number of occasions. His Honour inferred that the brothers had an understanding that the surviving brother would share the income of the flat with the deceased brother's family, or at least with his children, in the event that the surviving widow was viewed as a mere third party, such as an estranged but not yet divorced wife. Those factors combined meant that His Honour concluded that the intention was to create a tenancy in common, and the widow's claim was therefore going to succeed. I've set out a number of legal principles that we can take away from the decision. So how do you apply to VCAT to sever a joint tenancy? I think John covered that issue fairly well. I just wanted to run through a couple of provisions of the VCAT Act that are relevant to those types of applications. As you know, Section 67 spells out how to make an application. In other words, the application must be in a form and contain the particulars required by the rules. Section 97 provides that the tribunal must act fairly. Section 98 provides the tribunal is bound by the rules of natural justice, but it is not bound by the rules of evidence or any practices or procedures applicable to courts of record. And Section 109 says that parties bear their own costs unless they do something to merit otherwise. I just have a couple of comments to make about VCAT. The members who hear applications to the real property list of VCAT are experienced practitioners, and on the whole, that list provides good service. However, call me old-fashioned, but not applying the rules of evidence and court procedures to disputes that may involve millions of dollars seems to be fraught with risk, in my opinion. I just wanted to echo what Tony says about VCAT. What we're dealing with here, and I think I heard on the radio driving in today, that it's estimated that in around 12 years' time, the median price of real estate in the whole of Melbourne will be $1 million. That's the median price. Even now, the median price of real estate in Melbourne is over $500,000. Last Monday, there was a story in The Age that noted that 40 Melbourne suburbs now have a median price of over $1 million. So you can see that if you're dealing with disputes involving co-ownership of residential real estate in Melbourne, this is a substantial dispute. And I would submit that the risks are far too great to leave the decision-making to someone who doesn't apply the rules of evidence or doesn't have to apply the rules of evidence, doesn't have to apply proper procedural rules, and in fact can decide something on the basis of what they think is fair. So in those circumstances, as Tony has urged, I would also recommend that by hook or by crook, you get the case into either Supreme or County Court. In view of the time, I think I'll pan back to Tony.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree they were two excellent papers and presented excellently, identifying the relevant issues for your consideration when you go back to your practices and someone comes in with a property interest dispute. We have to be out of here, as I said, by 10 to 9. So we've got just over 10 minutes of questions for either of our speakers. If you could just put your hand up and I'll call the speaker who is and identify the relevant speaker for whom you from whom you require an answer, if you would. Yes.
Hi, my name is Sabine Phillips. I'm from Russell Kennedy. My practice is predominantly in aged care. And my question is in relation to the most recent
My question is in relation to the most recent Productivity Commission recommendations in aged care that make a provision for the compulsory severance of joint tenancies where one of a couple will be admitted to residential high care. And I'm just concerned of the fallout of that.
Who would like to take that question first?
Well, when you go into residential high care, obviously you've got to pay some sort of security bond, and I suppose what the commission is looking at is how the funding of the entry into the nursing home care is going to be paid for more than anything else. And the concern for all government departments is collecting money. If the resident goes into high care before the joint tenancy is severed, and so the surviving partner then takes the property, there's possibly no recall on the property because there's no estate left. So I guess that's where the Productivity Commission is headed.
What effect will that have, though, on the partner that still remains in the home in terms of the severance of the joint tenancy?
Well,
to raise the funds to enter the facility.
Well, the fundraising will happen whether it's a joint ownership or a tenancy in common, and they don't have money, they'll still have to raise the funds in any event. And so I don't think it's going to affect their application for finance. I think when people get to that sort of elderly age, often the only possible way of raising that sort of money is through the reverse mortgage process and things like that, because they've got no way of paying payments on a mortgage or anything else if they're on a pension. So it seems that whether it's a joint tenancy or a tenancy in common, with a reverse mortgage over the property, it's not going to really affect the outcome greatly, I wouldn't think.
Next question. Yes, if the roving microphone, the existence of which I wasn't aware before this seminar, could be placed in the hands of the questioner.
I just have a question in relation to the timing of the severance of joint tenancy where the court makes an order for the sale and division of proceeds of sale. Is the tenancy severed when the order's made or when the property's sold?
I think that's for you too, Bill, I suspect.
It's when the order's made.
So if the property's subsequently not sold, but there is a court order for the sale, that tenancy is still severed?
I believe so, yes.
I'm from State Trustees, so we often deal with disputes arising in families over the nature and extent of ownership of properties. Where there is a tenancy in common and there's a dispute over the proportion of that ownership, if one applies to VCAT for sale and division, how do we then deal with the disputed funds? So if we say that everyone owns 25% each and then there's, say, 50% still in dispute, can that amount be paid into court, or how do we deal with the disputed amount following the sale and before the resolution of the ownership dispute?
It would be held on trust. Certainly where state trustees are not involved, ordinarily it's held in trust by one of the solicitors involved, and usually the parties can make an agreement on who's going to hold it. You're in for a long dispute if that can't be agreed. And then that's where it remains until the tribunal makes a decision. But I certainly wouldn't oppose, if the other side proposed to me that it be held by state trustees, I wouldn't oppose that, but who knows what attitude you'll get when that suggestion's made.
But perhaps the question was, it seems to be a two-stage process. I'm not overly familiar with these recent amendments, but your question was directed, it's a given that you go to VCAT to get your severance. What happens to the funds in terms of proportions? And I put it to my panel, my boys, has VCAT got jurisdiction to deal with the division of the proceeds, or has it merely got the jurisdiction to deal with the sale and severance? And if it hasn't, do you have to go back to the Supreme Court to get a ruling?
Yes, it has. VCAT has jurisdiction to deal with peripheral issues.
Yeah. Well, I think there's the answer to your question. Yes?
In view of the comments that have been made concerning Supreme Court or VCAT, would the panel care to make a comment about the costs that are usually awarded in VCAT and the county court scales, and the time that it takes to get something on in VCAT as opposed to the Supreme Court?
I can answer that first. Section 109 provides a detailed code as to the basis upon which costs are awarded at VCAT. In the general situation, the costs will lie where they fall. But in a case which involves litigation analogous to litigation in the courts, such as the cases we're dealing with, that's when Section 109 and the cases touching upon Section 109 and its various subclassitum have to be carefully looked at. On the one hand, you've got the planning environment jurisdiction where 95% of the costs are a no-costs situation, although even then now, more often, Section 109 is being invoked if there's an element of fault or there's an element of contumelious behaviour or the like on behalf of one of the parties. But in a situation like this, the costs in VCAT... when I say this, I mean analogous to litigation situation. The costs in VCAT are more increasingly becoming awarded along the lines of the court, whether it be county court or Supreme Court. In terms of getting it on, many of these situations involving severance of joint tenancies relate to fairly urgent relief, and often they can be brought on in the Supreme Court, in the practice court, fairly quickly and disposed of fairly quickly. Sometimes, of course, if they involve someone taking defence that there's a constructive trust and oral agreements, of course it could take some years. But it seems to me the situation in VCAT's not all that much different. Quick justice is not always the best justice, particularly where insufficient attention is paid to the legal details of a situation. Certainly, generally, VCAT's quicker, maybe 6 months. In the Supreme Court, if it's a full-blown dispute, we all know what can happen. It could be 1, 2, even 3 years. But I don't think... I think VCAT's, particularly in a field where there are heavy commercial consequences, VCAT's very much coming closer to the Supreme Court, both in terms of its the cost implication and in terms of the time delay implications. I don't know what... perhaps get input from Bill and John on that.
I just wanted to add that you should make a call-to-bank offer, or the VCAT Act has, in the provisions that follow Section 109, there's provisions about offers of compromise, and you can improve your chances of getting a good cost order by making an intelligent offer, so I'd encourage you to consider that.
Yes, and, look, the costs of wherever you go are going to be significant. Any Supreme Court litigation, I would say the minimum outlay is going to be $50,000 or more. Probably a county court hard-fought dispute will be the same, and even a VCAT hard-fought dispute will be the same. And if you're if you're running the risk of not recovering costs in VCAT, then that's just another factor that you should take into account.
Thanks, Bill. Questions? Yes, this lady first, if our roving reporter...
Speak loudly. Given that decision, Bill, have you got any advice as to poor practitioners in a conveyancing practice that are instructed to draw transfers as tenants in common in unequal shares? This is likely to be overturned down the track at some stage, you know.
Well, again, if they're purchasing as in unequal shares, it's going to be based upon their contribution to the purchase price, one assumes. As long as you obtain full instructions and document it in a letter of advice to them, you tell me that you've purchased two-thirds and your brother's purchased one-third or something like that, then you'll be protected. And if you're already tenants in common, then you're not worried about severing the joint tenancy arrangements anyway. It's when the widow comes along and says, well, actually, my husband contributed the two-thirds, not the one-third. That all comes down to evidence, basically. The more evidence you can put into the situation up front, the better.
Yes. I think this is the last question. Yes.
Bill, it seemed to me that in that Klein matter, that was really a business situation. But what about in a domestic situation, second relationship, families of the former relationship, would the children of the first to go have the same sort of rights as the widow Klein in this particular matter? Would the judge be thinking the same way?
You're getting into probate sort of issues, and it probably depends on how much contribution was made by each partner, whether the children had any involvement in the contributions. I mean, adult children these days are always claiming, I helped mum and dad around the house, and I built the back room for them, and you know, whatever else it is. And so they're making their own equitable contribution into the family home. And so if they can establish some sort of claim on the deceased's estate because of their equitable contributions, then I think that certainly they'll be up there arguing it. And the judge will be having to give it some sort of consideration.
It's specifically recognised under Section 91(4) that, of course, the contributions that parties make to a deceased estate, but that's in a situation where they're challenging further provision under the will, or any provision under the will.
Yeah, I agree with that, but what if it's still infants, teenage children of the deceased person?
Well, they've hardly made any contributions, have they?
Yeah. Basically, if their parent goes into the new relationship and purchases as a joint proprietor and then deceases while they're still a young age, they may well be left destitute.
Yeah, that's the point I'm making.
Yeah, but there are 12 classes under Section 91(4), and
the contributions aren't just one, the moral obligation is paramount. And infant children have a paramount moral obligation or a claim on the estate. But as Bill says, that's very much a probate issue rather than a property issue, although the two do coalesce frequently. Yeah. Okay, well, that's the end of our session. I hope everyone has received some information from it, and I thank you for your attendance.